my dream job. I grew up, and other people did other things with their lives and sports. There was a football player, football coach. You know him, Tammy. George Curry from Berwick. He was Bosch's football coach. I had him for driver's training. Every week I would go out driver's training with this guy, and he tried to convince me, Jess, you need to be on this team. George, I really appreciate you teaching me how to drive better, but I got other things I'd rather do than play football. There is no something other than football, Jess. And anyway, so we argued and back and forth, but I never did go out. I stuck to my hunting and trapping and fishing. And so when I moved to Alaska, I was living my dream job. Not only earning a college degree, but we had a student body of about 200 people. That was a huge college, wasn't it? One third of them was Eskimos. One third of them was Indians. And the other third was Caucasians. And there was a couple guys from Ethiopia there even. So guess who I hung with? The Indians and the Eskimos. They did things that I wanted to do. And so we hit it off. Matter of fact, I was actually invited to be part of the Eskimo Olympics, the first white man to be part of the Eskimo Olympics. And I got a trophy in my office because of that. But I was living my dream. And I did enjoy it. And I still enjoy doing some of those things. But that's where I met Jesus, too. It's also where I met my wife, Marcy. I was her first patient on her first day of work at the hospital. Talk about coincidence, right, Patrick? And it's also where I got called into the ministry, and we'll get into that in a few minutes. The first winter up there, I did surveys for Fish and Game for about 6 weeks, some of December, all January, the cold times, and we went to a place where the White Pass was. Anybody ever hear of the White Pass? It was where they had the gold rush back in the 1890s, and people from all over the world were streaming to Skagway to go up to the White Pass and go up into the lands where you could find gold just laying right in front of your face. Some of them made some, and some of them lost their lives. Some of the roads they had to walk across, and it was a hard place to live. But we were doing surveys for Martin and Wolverine. And Wolverine, they're pretty ferocious. Anybody ever use a trap called a conibear? They have different sizes. You have some, Gary, or tried them? This is a 330. This is the biggest conibear they make. Huh? Or Wolverine. I made this cubby back in the woods and on my trail, and I put a dead Martin carcass back in there, and I set this 330 at the entrance, and walking along the train or trail, and I heard this chain rattling. I said, I got something. I got something big. It was a Wolverine, my first Wolverine, and it caught him around the neck and didn't even kill him. If you know how they work, Gary, you know, if I put my head through there, I would have been as dead as a doorknob, you know, but Wolverine. And one other thing I learned, Wolverines make the best gravy you could ever have. Yes, we just lived off of everything we could find and eat and whatever, but yeah, good gravy. The second winter, we went out to King Salmon, and I shot a moose up there. You know how much meat you get off of a moose? It was over 2,000 pounds. The game, Fish and Game said, this is a huge moose, 2,000 pounds. And so I had a trapping partner, and we were doing the surveys and stuff. And so I got it down, three shots with 30-06, 220 grain, and it just stood there and shook its head and looked at me. So I shot for its neck the third time, and it went down. But you don't move a moose that weighs 2,000 pounds back to your cabin. So what we did is we skinned it, and we gutted it. And this might sound kind of gross, but you see up in the tundra where King Salmon is, you probably didn't see too many trees up there, did you? Yeah, there was no trees up there for firewood. So guess what we did for heat? Nothing. I remember waking up inside the cabin, and they did have a thermometer there. I was tempted to just smash it. But I think the coldest night, 42 below zero. No heat. And I can remember taking my long johns up off right before we were going to go back. And this is honest truth. They were white, but they're not white anymore. They're kind of a dingy gray. And I took them over there, and they stood up by themselves against the wall. But we have this big moose. We got meat now for the rest of the time. And I'd go up every day. Oh, the gross part. How many here have ever gutted a moose before? Nobody? So you don't know if I'm telling you the truth or not, but I am. I will not lie. You had to literally climb inside of the cavity to get up and pull that stuff out of its neck. And with no heat for a month and a half, that was the warmest I was for all winter. Gross, huh? But we would go up every day, and we'd chop off this big chunk of meat, tenderloin or something like that, and bring back. And somebody asked me, well, what about the other critters? Didn't they go up and help themselves to that too? I said, yeah, but they're not going to eat a whole moose. You just look for a piece that didn't have too many bites on, and you chop it back off, and you take it down and you thaw it, and there's your breakfast, lunch, and dinner for that day. Well, I learned a lot about God up in Alaska, because that's where I finally gave in. I was raised in a church, but I had other dreams. One of my most frightening fears was that if I would ever give in to God, he would ask me to be something stupid like a pastor my whole life. And I did not want to be a pastor. You know, they have the collar up there, the choke collar or the tie, and you go visit 97-year-old ladies every day of your life, the rest of your life, and they never die. But so I avoided God like a plague. But when I finally gave in to God, I realized he was an amazing, amazing, loving father. He wants to have a relationship with us, even more than we want it. He wants it. And so I went thinking, why did I wait first 19 years to give in? Well, at least better late than never. And I want to tell you about one of my days working with the fisheries department in the summer. What we had to do is we built our own incubator in the hatchery on college ground. And the stream that came down, no salmon in the stream. So how many of you know salmon return to where they were born? Just like homing pigeons. I had homing pigeons more days than not growing up. And even married guy, I loved homing pigeons. Some of our kids, some of you might have went along. Remember, we'd go down and catch a half a dozen or a dozen of them down in the pigeon coop and put them in a cage and take them, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 miles away and let them go and see if we can beat them home without breaking the speed limit too much. They always beat us. They're very smart. Now, and fish are the same way, trout or salmon. They'll come back to where they were hatched. And so they come back. And one year, there was no salmon coming up the stream. And then we put our hatchery there. And next year, all those little salmon fry started swimming out into the ocean. And matter of fact, I took my fly tying kit up there because I loved to fly tie back then. And I seen what they were eating, Dolly Varner. They get about 24 inches long. So that's a nice sized trout. And they live in the ocean and in freshwater. So I tied little streamers that looked just like a salmon fry. And about every third cast, I'd get one of those lunkers on my line and a little fly pole. That was a challenge sometimes, but it was fun. And one of the days, I had an average day of work catching several hundred salmon, maybe sometimes closer to 1,000. You had to scoop them out and put the males in one holding pen, the females in the other. And then when you know they're ready to breed, what you do is you take a female and hold it by the head and tail and just tweak it a little bit. And the eggs come out, boop, 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 boop. And you know they're ready. And then you can collect the sperm and put them together, take them back in the hatchery, spread them around. You know the best thing to do is spread salmon eggs around in a hatchery. Don't get caught doing this. If you're thinking of doing this next week, the best thing to spread them around is an eagle feather. And there was lots of eagles in Alaska. And if we got caught, they said that the game commission will turn their eyes if they see you using one of those eagle feathers. But don't make a habit of showing it off. So we spread them around, and then they would hatch and go out. And we would have all these salmon in these holding pens. And I had a hard day of work catching all those salmon, poor guy, right? And dealing with them. And then some of them were ready to milk and take the eggs out then. And so a salmon don't live after they return to their grounds. So those we got to keep. We got them and take them home, put them in a smoker, and we smoked trout all winter long. And but one of the days I come home catching hundreds of trout, or hundreds of salmon, and bringing some home. I had to fillet them and put them in a brine, and I was pretty tired. And I sat down to my devotions. How many of you know God has a way of tricking you? God has a way of setting things up. Do you realize that God is probably the best poker player there is? God is the best chess player there is. And he knows what to do to get all those things just to line up. And for Jess Shingler to have that day coming home and just happened to be my devotions that night from John chapter 21. You can turn there or they'll put it up, I'm sure. I'm going to start reading in verse 4. And this was a time when Jesus showed up. He had already risen from the dead. He showed himself a couple times already, and they couldn't believe it. They were all a bunch of doubting Thomases back then. But verse 4, but when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. Verse 4, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to him, children, you don't have any fish, do you? How do you know that? because he's God. They answered him, nope, fished all night, but I caught no fishes. That's the song goes, right? And he said to them, cast your net on the right side of the boat, and you'll have a catch. Well, they got to lose. They didn't catch any fish all night long. We'll do it. So they cast, and then they were not able to haul it in because it was full of a great number of fish. Therefore, the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, do you know who the disciple that says several places that Jesus loved him more than the rest? It's John. John was one of his main guys. And therefore, the disciple said to whom Jesus loved, it's Jesus. So here is Peter, and I always liked Peter. He was one of my favorites. He would do about anything if he felt God was telling him to do it. And so the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for they were stripped for work. Now, you can use your own imagination. They probably were down to their skivvies. And I don't know if they wore the tidy whities or those other kind, but they were down to that, so they didn't get their good clothes dirty for the missus when they went home. And so he jumped right in the water, and the rest of them came following about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. So they got out of the land, on the land, and they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. Now, this is a question I have for Jesus. I asked him, but nothing came to mind yet. So this is one of those ones he's going to hold off to him in heaven. How did Jesus get those fish? Did he have a net? Did he have a Zepco 202 or something, you know, a fishing reel? But he had fish already laying on the fire cooking. He's inviting his friends to come on over and have some fish with me. And then he said, bring some of your fish, which you caught. Simon Peter went up and drew the net on land full of large fish, a number of 153 fish. And although they were so many, they didn't cause the net to tear. And then verse 12, gets into the interesting part, and this gets into the part where God really caught my attention. Remember, I was, in all honesty, I was a professional fisherman working for the fish and game, catching these salmon. That's what I was doing. It's what I liked to do. That was my dream since I was a little kid, and I got to live out my dreams. And Jesus said, in 12, Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. None of the disciples ventured to ask him a question, who are you, knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them and the fish likewise. This was now the third time that Jesus appeared to him or manifested himself to his disciples after he had been raised from the dead. So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Do you love me more than these? What's the these? The fish. It was his livelihood. That's what he liked to do. And, you know, when Jesus wasn't around, they said, well, let's go back and go fishing. Something we can do. Maybe catch some food for our family, earn a couple bucks. And Jesus was asking them, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with fishing. I still love to fish. Where's Joe? Took me up to New York State on a boat to go salmon fishing a couple years ago. And I caught my first king salmon up there. And so I don't know if he's your first, but it was my first. And I have a picture of it on my desk. And I have it facing everybody. So, Anybody goes into my office and say, who's that guy with those big fish? Well, that's Jess and Joe and his son. So anyway, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Peter said to him, yes, Lord, you know I love you. He said to him, tend my lambs. And you see how God's getting my attention now. I was in the same boat with Peter. I was catching those fish, and that's what I wanted to do. And I loved them. I loved the job. But now Jesus in my life, and again, there is no better job or worse job for God. As long as you're serving God in your job, we need Christians in every single occupation there is to be witnesses, because I can't do it. You can't do it. So don't feel like, oh, I have to quit and become a pastor and start going to nursing homes now too. No, you do what you feel God's given you to do. And if he has a different plan, he'll tell you. But he got my attention there. God, are you speaking to me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, tend my lambs. What's the lambs? His children, the Christians, okay? Take care of them. He said to him again a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? I could just imagine Jesus staring him at it right in the face. Maybe their faces were this far apart. Peter, do you really love me? And Simon said, Lord, yes, Lord, you know I love you. Then Jesus said to him, shepherd my sheep. Again, taking care of a flock, taking care of God's people. And he said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And then Jesus said, then tend my sheep. Now put yourself in my shoes. Live in your wildest dream in the wildest country that you've ever been or probably ever will be, in the middle of nowhere, eating Wolverine. And all of a sudden, he's saying this to me, Jess, do you love me more than these? And again, I love to fish. I still hunt. I still trapped until a couple years ago. Yes, Lord, you know I love you. Then I have a job for you, Jess. I have a job for you, Peter. I want you to start taking care of my sheep, feeding my lambs. Now, did I have training to know how to do that? Not at first, not at all. I didn't know what that would involve, where I would end up doing and where I'd be end up doing it. But I knew inside, you know, you ever have God speak to you and you know it's for you and it's clear and it feels like your heart's ready to jump out of your chest? That's how I was here. Yes, Lord, you know I love you. Then this is what I want you to do. Not just for a day. This is as long as you're second heir, almost 50 years now. This is what I want you to do. So that was my call into the ministry. These past years with kids camp, we had over 260 some kids here last year camping with us on these grounds. You see all these little cabins around here? That's where they go. And six campers and a counselor and an assistant counselor in each cabin. I don't know how many we have, but to count both sides, we probably have 30 plus cabins and more inside rooms. We We remodeled and done the youth center to fit more in last year. They come from all over the country, few outside of the country. We had over 11 states represented these last couple years. And no one ever leaves without experiencing what it means to have a living, personal relationship with Jesus. You can't get any more fulfillment than that. I could catch fish all day, but to see 200 and some kids give their life to Jesus and nobody leaves without having a relationship with God. Now, if I could, I'd keep them here forever, but the cooks would leave for sure. But Sylvia, you've been doing this a long time. Their favorite meal is taco night, right? Yeah. And I always say, make more than you need, because you don't know how much they're going to come back for seconds and sometimes thirds. We're making 200-300 tacos every Wednesday night. And how do you like to cook? Let's have people over for dinner. We'll cook them up 300 tacos. That's almost a call for divorce, isn't it? But anyway, that's why I push kids camp so much. I can remember giving a sermon years ago, 20-some years ago. Sometimes names just stick in there, sermon topics, certain titles. And you'll have to catch me, see if you can catch me what I'm trying to tell you. The sermon was, are you a prayer warrior? You know, a warrior. Sword and all. Are you a prayer warrior or are you a prayer warrior? You get it? A warrior. Oh, I don't know if I could do that. And you know what the prayer warriors, their favorite game is to play? What if? You think I can overcome some of these things? Well, I don't think so, because what if I need more money? What if my health goes down? What if I get laid off from my job? What if all these things? What ifs, what ifs, what ifs? And sooner or later, those what ifs kind of consume you. They do. So if you don't, matter of fact, I'm going through this little book right now. Someone recommended it to me. It's an amazing book. It says, Giving Up Worry for Lent. You know what Lent is? You know, you have those 40 days, and I've done that several times, and not every year, but this year I've decided I'm going to give up my worry for Lent. Now, I would have never guessed that I would be a warrior. I'm more the warrior type, okay? But last year before kids camp, if it could have went wrong, it went wrong. Right before kids camp, if we didn't have our water passed for purity, we couldn't legally open up camp. State wouldn't allow it. We have to get that certificate every year. It got down to 2 days before camp. 2 days. Was I worried? No, I'm not a worrier. Yes, I was worried. But we didn't have enough, near enough counselors. You know, we need at least 40 older teen, early 20 counselors to pull something like this off. All the kids get the personal attention and ministry they need. We didn't, I would say probably within 2 weeks before, we only had about half of what we needed. I had what the doctors determined, because Marcy said, you need to go in and see a doctor, find out what's going on. I had what they call 3 mini strokes. I didn't know what a mini stroke was. A major stroke, I mean, it could kill you, debilitate you, things like that. But mini strokes usually only last for a few minutes. But two of the 3 that I had, I was giving a sermon. And the first one was the worst and the longest, and it probably lasted maybe 2 minutes, 2-3 minutes at the most. But my family noticed, Marcy noticed, my kids noticed, and some of the others probably noticed. I was standing here and going through the sermon, and all of a sudden, like my mind went blank. I couldn't remember what I was supposed to say, what I was supposed to do, where I was supposed to read. I couldn't remember hardly anything. And I knew something was majorly wrong, but I kept just staying here. And after a few minutes, it came back and I was able to finish the sermon. But after three, Marsh said, you need to go in right now and get checked. So I went to my family doctor, Rich Pursuta, a good friend. He was a part of our church years ago, even over in Benton. And he said, I'm going to send you to several specialists because many strokes can be caused by three different things. Number one, you can have a heart problem, okay? So I went to this heart specialist and they put a monitor on me, taped to my chest. Wasn't too bad until they pulled it off, my hairy chest. But anyway, 2 weeks, I went back, I sent it in, and he called me back in. You have a great heart, especially for your age. You have an amazing heart. I could tell you had a heart attack years ago. I don't know how they could do that. But they said, do you remember? I said, yeah, I remember. What were you doing? I was walking around the back, lower 40. We don't have 40, we have 4. But anyway, call it lower 40. And all of a sudden, my heart started tightening up. What is going on? Luckily, it probably had to be God. What do I do here, God? What do I do? And I felt like God to say, speak life to your heart. Well, that's what Jesus did. Didn't he speak to storms? Didn't he speak to all these different situations? And he got some pretty good results. So I spoke to my heart. In the name of Jesus, heart, you were going to work as you were meant to work. And after a minute or so, the pain dissipated and it was gone and I never had another problem. So he said, check one off. It's not your heart. Okay. Now he sent me to a head specialist and they put me in the tube and all these different things to try to figure out what's wrong with this head. And afterwards, they said, there's nothing wrong with your head. Now, I know some people in my family would tend to dicker with that result, but it really was all right. So if it's not your heart, it's not your head, then it has to be worry. But I didn't see myself as a worry, but I guess I was. So now I'm going through the Lenten time learning how to turn my worries over to God better than I ever have before. And luckily, I got it all under control now. No. Look at Marcia shaking her head back there. But I'm making progress. So I want to throw three verses out to you before we close. First one is in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, this is a time when Paul was being used by God to point out specific problems that was going on in Corinth, where he was, the city area he was. And Paul was saying what they needed to do. And I'm going to read this one verse in chapter 7, and if you want to read before and after, you can. It's anything in the Bible is worth your reading, but this one verse really caught my attention, verse 32 of 1 Corinthians 7. But what I want you to be is free from concern. And when I read that, I would want that too. I want to be free from concern. No more what ifs. I just want to be free from my concerns. Anybody feel like that? That could be you too, just not Jess. The second one is in Luke chapter 1. Now, Matt back there and I are reading through Luke together. And we're both getting a lot out of it, aren't we? I am. And I've read it for years. I've read through the Bible the last 22 years and quite a few times before then. But we're going to turn to Luke chapter 1 and see what it says here. And this was the time when Mary realized that she was pregnant. And can you imagine not being married to anyone and realize this angel come in and said, you're going to be pregnant? What had to be going through her mind? I'll tell you what was going through her mind. This can't be. I'm a virgin. What am I going to tell my boyfriend? You just be honest, Tom. I know this might be a surprise to you, Joseph, but I'm pregnant. But don't worry, it wasn't by any other guy. God got me pregnant. Try telling that to your in-laws or even your parents. But that's where she was at. And during that time, the whole story of Luke 1, verse 26, down through about the end of the chapter, talks about Mary. And when she said, how can that be? And the angel said, furthermore, your cousin Elizabeth, in her old age, she's expecting too. You've got to be kidding. First, I got pregnant by God, and then my old relative is now in her 90s, and she's pregnant too. Was it God? No, it was just you, Mary. But she was saying, how can this be? In verse 37, the angel says this to her, for nothing will be impossible with God. Say that with me. Nothing will be impossible with God. Now, who said that? One of God's angels. And if he was lying, he wouldn't have his wings any longer, you know? It was God's angel that said that. Nothing will be impossible with God. Now, if that's the case, can anything happen in our lives that is a surprise to God? Now, you know I'm setting you up, don't you? Nothing can happen in our lives that God isn't aware of. Now, are there things that happen to us that we don't like? I've always been a hard physical worker, and I love to do it. And little by little, I have two new knees now, but I can't get down on them. The metal one's titanium or something that, you know, that Superman couldn't see through or whatever. And this last 6 months, something happened to my shoulders, and I went in. I can hardly lift them some days. I took a painkiller before I came to church. But I don't like doing this. I only take them if I have to. But the doctor said it's tendinitis. It's like an arthritis that gets in your muscles where they attach to your bones. I said, well, that doesn't sound good. What can I do about it? And remember, my doctor's Christian. He's part of a church. He said, wait to go to heaven. Well, that's encouraging, Rich. You know, there is no healing for it unless supernaturally God could do anything. But I can't even hardly use my arms some days. And but there's nothing impossible for God. Number one. And number two, he knows everything that's going on in my life. He knows. The last verse we're going to look at before we close is in Jeremiah 29. It's a very common verse. You've probably heard it several times before, but we're going to look at it in a different light today. Verse 11, and this is Jeremiah the prophet, one of the greatest prophets ever was. He was called the weeping prophet because he wept, he cried a lot when he was speaking for God. And I can relate. When I first became a Christian up in Alaska, I couldn't go to church and sing some of the songs without getting teary-eyed. And it was embarrassing, truthfully, because I'm a real man. Real men don't cry, right? To this day, I'm standing up here worshiping God. I had to get my handkerchief out because I'm crying. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think what God was doing was trying to take that Mr. America spirit out of me, the John Wayne thing, you know, and put a softer heart in here that I needed. And so this is what Jeremiah said from God to all the people. Now, you have to understand, all of God's people at that time, the majority of them were captured and hauled off to what's the name of the town? It's called, I wrote it down so I didn't forget. I did write it down, but I can't read my writing. It's in Iraq. Captivity into B-E-B-A-L. Babylon. I didn't even finish the words. Somebody got it. They hauled them off to Babylon. And so you can put yourself in this place. They were all pulled off out of their country, away from their families, and taken to Babylon. And they didn't know how long they were going to be there, if they ever get out. And this is what Jeremiah told them. For I know the plans that I have for you. You know God has plans for you and me. He has my days numbered, and I'm not going to die one day early or one day late. It's part of the plan. I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. That sounds like pretty good plans. Especially if you're a slave in Babylon doing whatever. How much that sounded to those slaves. I would say probably someone would say, well, we'll see, won't we? Sounds good, but we'll see. That would be a good time to use the what ifs. What if? What if these guys get really mean with me and I don't make enough bricks? What if I don't have enough food? What if, what if, what if? I'm going to close by getting you to repeat something after me. And if you don't want to repeat it, you don't have to, but it would do you good. And then one closing line to think about. So let's do the thing to repeat after me if you want to. Say this with me. I'll say it, and then I'll come back and get you to say it. God is really good at handling my future. God is really good at handling my future. No ifs, no what ifs. This is God. God is really good at handling my future. And then the last part, let's allow him to do his job. You know what I mean by that? Because, yes, God, you could handle my future, but I know you need me to jump in there and fix all the things that got messed up, right? No, let God do that. That's his job. You do your job, let God do his job. So one more time, God is really good at handling my future. Let's allow him to do his job. Could you see how that revolutionizes your life if you would really live by that one simple phrase, one simple line? And the last thought is this. If you want to grow close to God, then you need to make room for him in your life. You know, when I wrote that down, I thought, well, that sounds like a Christmas story. No room for him in the inn, right? No room for God in my inn. I can't make room. I'm already too busy as is. And I'm already doing all these good things. I'm helping people, God. I'm serving you. And they might be good things, but if you don't have any time to get into God's word on a daily basis, just like Matt and I are doing, you're going to miss out, Jess. So I have to make room for God in my life. Make room for God in my life to read my Bible. Make room for God to pray. Make room to come to church. But you don't understand. This is my one day to sleep. Make room for God. If you want to get close to God, and God will show you how to do that. There's been times that God, I feel like I'm a little overwhelmed. I need to cut some things out. And God will put with ideas. Well, you could give this up. You could goodbye without that. And I, well, what about, and there I go, the what ifs. Okay? You just take his advice and it works out. So God, I just pray for all of us here today, myself at the top of the list, that we could learn to trust you more than is humanly possible, maybe for all of us. But you can help us to trust you. You can give us that ability, that grace, that mercy, to be able to trust you so that we can continue to hear from you and get closer to you. And when you call us to do something like me, as far as you love me more than these, we have to answer them, because some of them, the these, won't even be our occupation. They could just be the things you like to do. But whatever it takes to make room for him so that we'd have room in the end for him. God, I thank you for helping me through my struggles. I think I got it all figured out. You'd think so after 49 years as a pastor, 50 years as a Christian. But I don't. I'm going to need you the rest of my life. And I'm not ashamed to say it. I need you. We all need you. Help us to make room for you in our lives. Get into the word. Get into the church. Have a family. Church family that can encourage you. Get into prayer. Listen more than you talk. You know, God gave you two ears, but only one mouth. So in your prayer time, you can jabber a little bit, but don't let it get past one third, because two thirds is for hearing. He has a lot more to say to us than we could ever say about ourselves. Thanks for coming, and thanks for being part of what we did.